This episode of Midori House was first broadcast on the 10th of February 2015 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Tuck. On today's show...
It is a national decision for each country in the NATO alliance to decide whether to supply lethal aid to Ukraine. The UK is not planning to do so, but we reserve the right to keep this position under review.
British Foreign Secretary Philip Hammond there. The UK, like the US, is keen to avoid further arming Ukraine. But will they change their approach if there is no solution on the horizon for Ukraine after the crisis is discussed in Minsk tomorrow? Kathleen Burke and Isabel Hilton will join me to discuss the biggest news stories of the day. Also, an experiment on human psychology that goes very wrong. Author Dylan Evans joins me in the studio to explain why his attempt at living with no modern technology and comforts turned into a disaster. Then we'll review the fresh German newsweeklies with Imke Henkel of Die Zeit. And then music expert Crispin Parry will review some of the most interesting Brazilian music releases. That's all to come on Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. So lots coming up in the next hour here on Midori House. But before all of that, here's Jonathan Wheatley with the latest news.
The Syrian president Bashar al-Assad has claimed that his armed forces are cooperating indirectly with the US-led air campaign against Islamic State militants who seized large parts of his country. He also dismissed as childish allegations that his forces had killed thousands of civilians by dropping barrel bombs on rebel-held areas. Shashank Joshi of the Royal United Services Institute said that Assad's claims of cooperation with the coalition are exaggerated.
Cooperation is completely the wrong word for this. What may be happening is deconfliction. That is, a coalition may be saying, we are flying missions over Raqqa or this place very heavily this week. Keep your planes away or they will be shot down. I would call that more of a threat or a warning, at best, deconfliction at worst, than I would call it any kind of cooperation. I honestly do not think that there's any cause to think that we're exchanging information about targets, about logistics in any broader sense, about the state of the insurgency.
The United Nations has said that peacekeepers in Central African Republic used helicopters to bombard positions held by a rebel faction in a town northeast of the capital in which six rebels died. The UN peacekeepers and French troops hit government buildings in the town of Bria, occupied by the Popular Front for the Renaissance of Central Africa, a faction of the mainly Muslim Silika rebels. Thousands have been killed and around a million have been displaced from their homes in violence that's gripped the country since they took power in March 2013. Ukraine's President Petro Poroshenko said rocket strikes hit Ukraine's military headquarters at Kramatorsk in the east of the country, wounding many army personnel and civilians. Kramatorsk is 30 miles from the front line and from where Kiev military directs its campaign against pro-Russian separatists. The news comes as the US president said earlier that he may approve plans to send defensive weapons to Kiev's forces. Well, the head of the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, Lamberto Zenia, says separatists in Ukraine seem constantly supplied with weapons which appear to be arriving from the border with Russia.
As weapons get destroyed during the military operations on the separatist side, they always seem to have new weapons at hand. So these weapons must come from somewhere. That's all we can say. We are present in larger numbers on the Ukrainian side, and we have never seen weapons from there going into the east. So our conclusion is that they must come from the other side. Obviously, that's the Russian border.
The head of Massachusetts' transportation authority on Tuesday defended the decision to close Boston subways and rail service after a string of snowstorms that's hammered the northeast United States in the past 2 weeks. Schools around the Boston area also remain closed today as crews struggle to clear roads after a three-day storm dropped 2 feet of snow across the region. They warned that the weight of the snow could result in collapsed roofs. And the UN Human Rights Office says it's disappointed by the Malaysian federal court ruling upholding the conviction and fine 5-year jail sentence of opposition leader Anwar Ibrahim on sodomy charges. Lawyers for the former deputy prime minister had appealed against the verdict handed down in March last year when the 67-year-old was found guilty of sodomising a former political aide. The maximum punishment for the offence can be 20 years in jail, while Amnesty International's Olaf Blomqvist said that the charges had clearly been politically motivated.
Criminalising consensual sex between adults is completely against international human rights, and it's also something that sort of enables this political persecution in Malaysia. And we're really calling on the Malaysian authorities to remove the sodomy statute from the criminal code immediately.
And that's the news here on Monocle 24.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres, essa é a Monocle 24.
Oi, London, this is Monocle 24.
Ot London, tu er Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette er Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Holanda.
London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London. London.
This is Monocle 24.
And you're listening to Midori House, and the time here in London is 18.06, which means it's 13.06 in New York. And joining me now with their take on the news is Kathleen Burke, Professor Emerita of Modern and Contemporary History at UCL in London, and Isabel Hilton, Editor of China Dialogue. Welcome both to the programme. Well, fighting has intensified in eastern Ukraine, while the leaders of Ukraine, Russia, France and Germany are getting ready to meet tomorrow in Minsk. The EU has put off further sanctions against Russia, saying that we'll first want to see what tomorrow's discussions produce. Isabel, let's start with you. We don't know what will be produced, but we did have an agreement in Minsk before. Minsk has become a strange kind of like Geneva for this event. Oddly,
it's become shorthand. Yeah, frustration, really.
A weird diplomatic capital in the making. But when we look at the talks happening tomorrow, we've seen so much kind of shuttle diplomacy from the Germans over the last few days. Do we feel this is building up to something or building up to another round of disappointment?
Well, it's impossible to say, but I think what it does show is the profound German conviction that they have to stave off a military escalation of any kind at this point from the Western side. And, of course, the challenge for Merkel is to get delivery on anything that Putin agrees. First of all, can you believe anything Putin says? And secondly, would he deliver if he promised something? And that remains an unknown. However, it's Merkel's conviction that there are other ways to support the Ukraine. And I have to say, I rather agree with her, that I think that it's a gift to hand to Putin, the idea that NATO will arm Ukraine if he doesn't behave, because that simply plays into his narrative that NATO is the aggressor.
Kathleen, there was a New York Times commentator yesterday saying that, you know, people don't realise we're taking steps which could lead to, you know, a third world war. And I was just looking at Mr. Klitschko, the one-time hopeful for the presidency of the Ukraine. He's put out a statement a couple of days ago saying the same thing. He fears that there is a military set of steps that could happen here that could be far more catastrophic than anyone's really kind of considering at the moment.
Well, it's very difficult, isn't it? I mean, it's quite easy to give away someone else's country. And it's also a touch and go whether it's better to say this far and no further, because that will stop them, or you say this far and no further, and they'll say, right, here I leap over it. I would hate to be, I must confess, a decision maker at this point. There's no, I mean, it's not, well, sort of going to be lose-lose, isn't it? With any luck, Ukraine, the original Ukraine, will get 4/5 of its country back. Ideally, a ceasefire line that will hold more often than not. The Russian speaking at the eastern end will get their own autonomy and closer links with Russia. So does that mean it's going to be the start of a drive down towards Mariupol so that there's an entire continuing link of land that so that there's a defendable lunk of land that can be held easily. I understand why Merkel is doing this. We all understand why Merkel's doing it. Germany would be right on the front line if anything happens. On the other hand, Poland says, right, If the U.S. arms were right there, Lithuania's already given lethal arms. Those who have had really direct experience of what was the Soviet Union are not keen on letting Putin think he only has to growl and the West backs off.
Isabel, the problem is that we've allowed it to happen twice, but, you know, more than twice before, but certainly we allowed a chunk of Georgia to be taken away, two chunks of Georgia in effect to be taken away, Abkhazia and then Ossetia. Then we saw the same happen, you know, with Moldova has a bit that's held by the Russians. So, you know, when Putin looks at what the options are, he probably doesn't think there's much likelihood of any kind of military escalation on the West side, really. Do you think he's just, you know, you said we don't know whether to hold him to his word ever, but do you think he feels he can just push and push and push until he's really kind of, you know, in effect had ethnic cleansing in the eastern side of Ukraine and taken the land that he wants and taught Ukraine a lesson?
Well, I think that not all those cases are the same. In particular, I think the Georgia case was a slightly different case, and there was more of a story on both sides in that instance. I don't think we can put Ukraine entirely back together again as it was. That doesn't, I think, mean that we give away Ukraine. There are many things Ukraine needs, perhaps in addition to weapons. It needs massive economic support, which Germany and the United States and indeed, I suppose, the European Union are in a position to supply. Because in addition to the military aspect of Putin's operation, there is the strangulation aspect. And I think that making sure that that does not succeed is in a way an easier proposition. The difficulty is that the frustration with Putin's, you know, lack of response or lack of integrity, if you like, tends to encourage people to think that a hard power option is going to be a solution. My question, as you know, with all the recent uses of hard power in similarly frustration situations, is that, you know, show me where it really delivered. Show me where it succeeded. And I think it is very dangerous. I'm with the Germans on that one. The Poles have backed off slightly since the change of government. I think they are being slightly less muscular. And clearly there is no easy answer to this, but I would be very careful about a military escalation here, because at that point it really does get out of control.
But do you think, Kathleen, that, you know, when you, if you're sitting, as you know, we were saying, if you're sitting in, you know, Riga or in Tallinn or in Warsaw even, that, you know, there is a pressure for something a little bit more aggressive, because these countries think, oh, look, we've got, you know, certainly the Lithuanians and the Estonians and you know, they've got large Russian contingencies of people, citizens living in their within their borders, and the same is, you know, potentially could happen again.
They are terrified of this, and there's no obvious reason why it shouldn't, except that, of course, NATO is putting together this sort of small but perfectly formed rapid reaction force. They are flying along the borders and so forth. The problem is the NATO alliance is like turning around an unwieldy tanker. Nothing gets done in a hurry, and by the time they agree, by the time we see Minsk, by the time this happens, you know, another 30 square miles is gone. It is difficult. I agree with Isabel. What we really need is a lot more financial help. The U.S. has been training. The U.S. has been helping with command and control formation. A lot more of intelligence help would you know, some jamming equipment, things like that, I think would be far safer, as well as far more useful than in 2 months' time taking some lethal defense weapons will ever be. But I agree, the problem is once the shot is fired, you can't pull it back.
And just before we move on, do either of you have an opinion on Mr. Lukashenko's rise? Because it's strange. You know, he's you know, in an interesting territory. You know, he has another country which, you know, Russia doesn't seem to quite recognize as being completely independent. They think he's done a good job for now, but, you know, one day will it be back in the fold? But so he's striking an interesting balance, isn't he? He's trying to, you know, Isabel, he's trying to be neutral on one, you know, between these two kind of factions, and he's suddenly found himself very useful.
Yes, it's a dangerous position being useful, however. It can change very quickly. I wouldn't really want to be in his shoes.
Good. Well, we're going to move on now to Greece, which oddly has a connection with this story, because the Greek defence minister, who is Panos Kamemos, has issued a warning clearly targeted at Berlin, saying that Greece has a plan B. If the country fails to get a new debt agreement with the Eurozone, it will look for help elsewhere. And the other providers could be the US or potentially Russia or China? Isabel, let's stay with you. So what's interesting is, you know, the Chinese were in discussions to buy Piraeus, to become the owners of the port. But, you know, do you think, you know, there's a, and, you know, we're talking about two left-leaning countries in theory, but mm-hmm. do you feel that there, beyond that, there's a reason why the Chinese would want to step in and bail out Greece?
It's not terribly obvious to me, but and I can quite see the, you know, it's sort of waving the flag at the European Union is it seems like a good idea for the Greek defence minister, but I haven't heard an enthusiastic response from either Moscow or Beijing to this plan. Operating the port of Piraeus, which they've done rather successfully, is if you like, a business proposition. There's a strategic element to it also that China is quietly operating and building ports all around the world. So one day we might find that we can't sail anywhere without Chinese permission. That's rather different from supporting a country that's on the verge of bankruptcy. There's a lot of Chinese debt out in the world. You know, if you look around Latin America, for instance, look at Ecuador or Venezuela, you find that the Chinese have a lot at risk already in deals in which they have put in large sums of money in return for long-term contracts on oil, for instance. In Venezuela's case, a lot of loans, which they may well lose. Chinese have, of course, a large war chest, but it's a diminishing war chest. You know, their foreign reserves are shrinking, their economy is slowing. And they would also, I think, weigh quite carefully the political implications. And I'm not sure that I see the political gain for China in doing that.
Catherine, do you think there'd be any gain for we can see some obvious potential gains for the Russians. You know, that they have a nice Mediterranean port in Syria, which isn't the easiest place to operate from. Maybe they'd like a nice port in Greece. You know, they do have a desire to tweak the tail of the, you know, the European Union. Do we think that there's any kind of legs in this idea?
Well, there's a couple of things there. First of all, it depends on if you think of the monopoly approach to influence. That is to say, would China or Russia like to pick up another country, as it were, which is one without worrying too much about the strategy, just as you go around the monopoly board and take Reading if you get the chance, not because you necessarily want it.
Old Kent Road is what it's put
in. You didn't play it in California. There's a couple of things. First of all, I agree with Isabel. How would they pay for it? Russia is not in the most strongly economic position at this point. I can imagine the U.S., they're falling about laughing at the mere thought. They're even thinking, well, maybe $3 billion is too much for Ukraine. What do we give for a clapped-out country, essentially? But in terms of ports, we have to remember that Greece is part of NATO. When push comes to shove, Russia and China are not going to get ports. It was obviously, Kamenos is, he's independent Greek party. He's not even Syriza. That was thrown out probably to threaten, if you don't help us, look where we can go. But I'm sure he hasn't checked it out with any of those three countries. I don't think that's a starter at all.
Well, we're going to take a short break now, but you're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck, Catherine Burke and Isabel Hilton.
The brand new M24 iPhone app brings you the full radio offering from Monocle 24. Listen live to our four daily news programmes or catch the freshest tunes on our playlist. And of course, there's the Time Shift, where you can delve into our show archive and listen at your leisure. All our great magazine programmes covering everything from international affairs to culture, design to urbanism, food and drink to entrepreneurship. It's all available anytime on the new, free Monocle 24 iPhone app. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
What designs will you be wearing next season? How will architecture change the face of your city? And which redesign will affect the paper you pick up?
It's very strange. It's like two triangles and two squares more. But I think that's a stimulus for the architect.
The kerning can take 5 times as long as actually designing the letter forms, which seems fairly brutal.
Is it going to perform? Is it going to stay the same? Is it going to be the same? That's normal anxiety.
Good design improves our lives. If you want to find out how, join me, Monocle's design editor Tom Morris, every Tuesday on Monocle 24.
And Welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Still with me is Kathleen Burke and Isabel Hilton. Well, Syria's President Bashar al-Assad has revealed that his government receives updates from the US-led coalition on the airstrikes against the Islamic State. In an interview with the BBC, he denied any direct cooperation with the coalition, saying that the messages he receives are indirect through third parties, including neighbouring Iraq. An extraordinary interview. Every time we hear this man speak, you know, he's kind of holed up in Damascus. His sense of, you know, what the world thinks of him and what's really happening seems to not really match anybody else's. Kathleen, what did you make of the interview?
Well, I mean, like everyone else around this table, I was absolutely riveted, especially by the throwaway line about cooking pots. That, of course, they don't have barrel bombs. They don't even have cooking pots. I would not be surprised that there is a exchange or whatever, or a conveying of intelligence on that side. The United States can be, in many respects, rather movable about its friends and its allies. You can ask all sorts of military autocrats around the world who were once American allies. And in this case, if they think ISIS is the worst, in that case, they'll go along and cooperate with anyone who will be helpful. Assad cannot say this, of course, but I would be, you know, the more one thinks about it, I would be astonished if it weren't happening.
Isabel, you watched the interview as well. You know, do we think he's a man who's, you know, who really believes all this? Who believes he's actually protecting his citizenry, and he's not, you know, that his army is not bombing his people?
Well, he wouldn't be the first dictator to present himself as, you know, his people's friend. It's a pretty universal trait. Saddam Hussein did it too. Whether he believes it, it's curious, isn't it? I think that you have to, if you're in that position, say these things, and if you say them often enough, you have to, you know, you can, it's the only truth you admit, if you like, whether you really believe it or not. But I think that events, if you like, have come to his rescue, in that he always argued that the opposition was not a moderate, you know, nice, you know, liberal grouping that the West would like to characterize. And the West is vulnerable to confusion, in that we like to think that we're supporting liberal democratic forces against dictators. We have a rather Manichaean view of our own. It is sufficiently true that the opposition to Assad also contains some people we would not like to be supporting. So it's a mixed picture and not a straightforward proposition. Also, I think the way that the Arab Spring turned out has made people pause rather in their certainties about everyone who opposes a dictator is worth supporting. So for all these reasons, plus the appearance of Islamic State, I think that Assad's fortunes in terms of his prospective alliances under the table or in the open, looking rather good right now.
Kathleen?
Well, except that the position he's in right now, I mean, fundamentally, I agree with you, in terms of all of his enemies are now becoming everyone else's enemies, which is always very useful. On the other hand, he's been at war for 4 years. He's not actually gaining back much territory. The most he can hope for now is he runs through his armory, he runs through his trained soldiers, is not to lose anything else, try to just keep things as they are. This is not a terribly wonderful war cry. Stay here, if you see what I mean. So in that sense, he's not losing, but he's not gaining. And the question is everyone else going to, you know, stand back and watch and see who goes over that, you know, this crevasse first? And if it's the wrong side, then what do we do? And what is the wrong side?
Do both of you, when you look back at, you know, it was great to believe that these Arab Spring revolutions would deliver, you know, democracy. And it's been a terrible litany of disasters when we look at Libya, when we look at Egypt. Do you feel that many Western leaders are probably feeling that, yeah, and in Iraq as well, but feeling that, you know, actually it's probably better to kind of allow some of these kind of dictators to hold their positions rather than have what we have with ISIS, for example?
Well, I think it's a lesson in that sign that you get in antique shops: if you break it, you own it. And I think it's been an extremely sobering lesson since Iraq. I have to say, widely predicted. Neither Iraq nor Afghanistan can be portrayed as a great success. And I think this this rather Manichaean view that I talked about has been tempered quite a lot. So whether it's about leaving dictators where they are or allowing the process of evolution beyond dictatorship to happen at an, if you like, a more indigenous pace, where you're likely to get a more solid result, where you're likely at least to know what's happening, and where you're not, where you don't become a player, because as soon as you become a player, then you muddy all the political waters. And I think, I would hope those lessons have been learned. And I think actually Syria tells us they probably have. Nobody has leapt in Syria.
Catherine, we're doing fantasy politics here now, but if we could roll back events 5 years and, or 6 years, 7 years, and we could have left those administrations in place in Libya, in Egypt, you know, all the way through to Syria, do you feel the world would be a safer place? Now, I'm not talking about, you know, the quality of life of the people who live in those countries, which was tough, they were brutalised, there was political torture. But as in the world a safer place, you know, has it been a complete political failure supporting these movements?
Yes, as I was going to say, safer for whom, before you said ignore all those and let's look at the rest of the world. I mean, Tunisia has done quite well. It's all the others that have been difficult. It would be safer in the same way that the Cold War was extremely safe. Neither side... The Berlin Wall meant that both sides could consolidate and sort of relax a bit. The question of nuclear weapons became much less threatening. So yes, stasis and balance of power is always safer than unexpected, calamities or unexpected events. That's the main thing, is that one difficulty with Putin is you cannot predict what he's going to do. And therefore, that's what makes him so dangerous. Not that he's so hugely military-ridden and certainly doesn't have the money, but it's because you can't predict what he's going to do. And that's what makes it dangerous. And what made the Arab Spring dangerous is it turned out we could not predict what was going to happen. And therefore, there was nothing anyone could actually do about it once it began.
Well, we're going to move to a different topic now. We're going to finish with the HSBC files and the Chinese names on it. A leaked data reveals how the Swiss arm of the world's second biggest bank helped wealthy customers conceal assets worth billions of dollars. The list includes names from all over the world, including China. Isabel, some of the names have obviously come out already. What do you make of this story?
Well, it's a delicious story, and we should read it against the corruption drive. So one of the very interesting things about this list is that there are a whole series of people who are actually already in jail and have been caught in the anti-corruption drive. However, we could divide the list into those who are already in jail, those who might go to jail, and those who certainly won't go to jail. And in that latter category, we have the close relations of several former prime ministers. One of them is the daughter of the former Prime Minister Li Peng, who is an extremely unpopular former Prime Minister because he was the one who put the tanks into Tiananmen back in 1989. And he then rammed through the People's Congress the legislation that permitted the development of the Three Gorges Dam. And his sons and daughters then became prominent executives in Chinese utilities, so they all got rather rich. She has 2.4 million or had 2.4 million in a Swiss bank account. I would have thought probably one of several bank accounts, honestly, thinking of what she might have made over the years. The other family name that's come up before, one of the sons of Wen Jiabao, who is the last prime minister and brother-in-law of Wen Jiabao. Wen Jiabao was rather a popular Chinese prime minister, known as Grandpa Wen, because it was his job to turn up at disasters and express sympathy. But Bloomberg made themselves deeply unpopular by publishing a very, very well-researched takeout on the $3 billion that his friends and relations, mostly his relations, had squirreled away, including his elderly mother, who was clearly a genius investor who ended up extraordinarily rich. So I think they're not likely to go to jail. There are some relations of Li Keqiang, unfortunately, also currently prime minister, and another man who has spoken out against the enrichment of the families of the powerful. So I think that this is going to cause great interest and pleasure in China.
Is it getting coverage? Do we know going back in China?
I haven't seen any as yet. Bloomberg, of course, has been banned since they did their takeout, as has the New York Times Chinese service since they did a similar exercise on Xi Jinping's family. So it is a slightly risky business, but you could cover at least the ones who are in jail.
Kathleen, when you look at this list, the story has been really—it's gripped every country. Everyone's keen to see who from their citizens has had their bank account details revealed. Is it, tax is suddenly a global story, isn't it?
Well, yes, mostly because everyone's filthy rich people have their tax monies, what ought to be their tax monies, in someone else's bank. No one has their tax monies hidden away in their own country's banks, which means there's an incredible crisscrossing of links and tenuous lines. What's interesting is we've moved as from tax evasion areas or tax avoidance from islands to countries. Now, is it going to move further inland? I don't know. But yes, that's a story that's going to run and run. It's not just there. Think of the Germans, think of the French, think of the British. And we still have, I suspect, a lot of the Americans, which hasn't caused as much interest as I think it will do.
Well, it's certainly a story that's been making the headlines here on the BBC, on The Guardian, and many news organisations who got the data. We're going to have to leave it there, but thank you both very much for a very enthralling start to the show. That was Kathleen Burke and Isabel Hilton on Midori House.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette Monaco 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost. Se on Monaco 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Monaco 24 des.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monaco 24.
Well, we've still got plenty to come in the second half of today's Midori House. The author, academic and philosopher Dylan Evans will join me in the studio to tell me how his experiment of living in the Scottish Highlands with no modern technology or comforts went so horribly wrong. We'll also be joined by the journalist Imke Henkel, who will review the German weeklies for us. But before we get started on that, here's Jonathan Wheatley with the world news headlines.
Thanks very much. The Syrian president, Bashar al-Assad, has claimed that his armed forces are cooperating indirectly with the US-led air campaign against Islamic State militants who seize large parts of his country. Ukraine's president said rocket strikes have hit Ukraine's military headquarters in Kramatorsk in the east of the country, wounding many army personnel and civilians. The UN Human Rights Office says it's disappointed by the Malaysian federal court ruling upholding the conviction and five-year jail sentence of opposition leader Anwar Ibrahim on sodomy charges. And the United Nations has said that peacekeepers in the Central African Republic used helicopters to bombard positions held by a rebel faction in a town northeast of the capital in which six rebels died. And for the moment, that's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London.
Essa é a Monocle 24.
From London,
in London, London,
cara. De Londres.
Esto es Monocle 24.
Well, welcome back to Midori House, live here on Monocle 24. The time in London is 18.33. It's 21.33 in Moscow and 16.33 in Rio de Janeiro. And it's time now for a look at what's making the news in the fresh German weeklies. And joining me in the studio is Imke Henkel, Die Zeit Online's London correspondent and a regular voice here now on Monocle 24. Very, very nice to see you. Where do you want to start with today?
I'd like to start with Die Zeit, actually. And they have a very interesting dossier, as it calls. So it's a very long article, it's an analysis about the middle classes. And everyone is saying that the middle classes are squeezed. There's an issue in the moment as well in Britain, I think in many European countries. And in fact, they're saying that is a lie. They believe they are squeezed, but in truth, they are not. And they list quite a few tax policies that prove that, and actually quite to the contrary, being squeezed, they are benefiting from tax policies. One of the most prominent is what they call parent benefits, probably, so for young mothers or fathers to take off a year or so. And they actually, of course, everyone gets it, but because it, in Germany it's linked to the last salary that you get, it's far more for the middle classes. And in fact, apparently there are already websites in Germany and books who give you tips how to travel through the world when with this kind of benefit and being away and spending a lovely time in Portugal or in Brazil or whatever.
What's fascinating is that I think that in the UK there's a, you know, not only is there a similar idea of the squeezed middle, but there's also this idea that, you know, that there's a kind of failure for, you know, actually the country's not doing too badly. You know, salaries are ticking up a little bit, not as fast as probably they should do. There's more people in employment. Yeah, not all the jobs are full-time jobs, but things are better than they were. But people don't feel better. People feel still this kind of sense of being squeezed. And it's interesting. It's almost the same story in Germany then.
No, I think that's actually different in Germany. And I think in that way, it's very an German phenomenon that in fact the middle classes are not squeezed, but quite to the contrary, they're quite well off and they're quite comfortable. And I think that actually explains a lot of the politics that's going on. That
but what I'm saying is it a failure for the feel-good factor to be, you know, passed on, you know, that, you know, that while they should feel a bit better about their life, they just don't feel it.
Yes, that's right. They just don't feel. They think they're squeezed, but they're not taking into account how many benefit they get. And I think the situation really is different in the UK because the economics and situation is different in the UK and inequalities are larger here. But I think it's rather the middle classes are actually quite comfortable off in Germany and just not realising this. And being he's saying so one would have made would have to make the miles there. Of course, a lot of people who claim to the contrary, but I find the arguments indeed side quite convincing, I have to say. And also, that is a kind of pressure group that sort of shapes politics, which actually brings comes to the next topic, which is huge in Germany, and that is Greece. I think actually it's more noticed in Germany than in other countries. I recently spoke to a colleague from Sweden, I think to some other countries as well, and asked them which is the biggest topic in your country. Everyone said Ukraine and Russia. And actually only Germany seems to have first Greece and then slowly because, oh yeah, there's something going on in Ukraine
now,
as well.
Now, Desire has an interview with the finance minister, Varoufakis.
Yes, absolutely. And it's basically seemed around this debate, oh, you are a provocateur and you want us to pay for everything. And he trying to explain, we need to talk. It does make sense that in to say if we have someone only earning 300 euros or so a month and we give them another 300 euros, that doesn't mean we are holding the reforms.
And what did Design make of Varoufakis in the end, do you think? Do they feel he's a... just an interesting character, or do they despise him?
I think they're actually quite measured about him, and they really let him talk and explain his ideas. Quite to the contrary, to the Spiegel actually last week, who had a very controversial titles and saying the one, the Geisterfahrer, so the one that drives on the wrong side of the road, and they actually bringing up again this probably middle-class argument in Germany that German taxes pay for Greece. And interestingly, most people they talk to, most experts and they let talk, are German economists, German politicians. And they should maybe come to London or talk to some international economists who probably would have more understanding of what Varoufakis is saying and what the Greek government is saying.
Because there is also this story in Der Spiegel, isn't there? This is the Tsipras about Tsipras about the protests and the taxation and how Greece is kind of ticking along. What is Der Spiegel saying?
Yeah, absolutely. The Spiegel's basically making the point that was last week's issue that Greece is going down a provocative road, that the new government started off with making some quite rude remarks about Germany, about Merkel. So Which, of course, is true, and it certainly doesn't make the situation easier. But on the other hand, they do not try to go for the thoughtful argument that certainly came out from the Greece government.
So tell me, you know, what's interesting is, you know, that it's kind of personal between Germany and Greece. You know, we saw this you know, unusual symbolism of, you know, the laying of the flowers to the, you know, the fighters who had fought the Nazis. You know, as, you know, obviously an important gesture for any Greek leader to do, but it felt that it was done in a very unusual way when Tsipras took power. The language between, you know, Berlin and Athens, it's not nice. There's a kind of tension in the air. And do you feel that that's then felt by readers of these papers, that they're, you know, they feel a little bit kind of uncomfortable at how they're being, you know, prodded by the Greeks?
Yes, I think absolutely. I think that is definitely the feel that many people in Germany have, which I hugely regret, because I think what is behind is a kind of ideology that hasn't been really put into question, probably up to a point in both countries. And in fact, in the end, it really comes down to two ideological sides in Europe. It's really the question whether austerity politics is the one that will work in the end, or whether it's actual reform politics, growth politics that will work in the end. But it also, of course, in Greece, of course, is the atrocities, the German atrocities during Second World War and during Nazi time, of course, are very much in the forefront. And I have to say there's a kind of imbalance there between the countries. Although these atrocities are, of course, very well known in Greece and are very present, and not too many people, I think, before they now repeatedly were mentioned recently, really were that aware that Greece is another country that usually suffered from a German invasion.
Yeah, and it's fascinating. You know, obviously, there's a kind of amnesia about some of the events there, potentially. But, you know, also, there is a generation of Germans who have grown up post-war, liberal-minded, had their holidays in Greece, and they feel kind of, you know, a bit kind of under attack. This is very just quickly before we wrap up today. Richard von Weizsäcker died, the former president of Germany. Yeah. Maybe presidents of Germany aren't so well known around the world as the chancellors are. But what did, you know, Der Spiegel and Der Stern? Yeah. They both had obituaries for him. Yeah. Is he lauded as a great man?
Yes, absolutely. He is considered to be a huge figure, and one central issue. And one central reason for that is because he did, in fact, give a great speech on the 8th of May in the 80s in Israel. And Israel, of all places, he said, yes, every German should have known, could have known about the Nazi and crimes, and should have stand up. And actually, when the Allies came, it was a liberation for us. So it was a huge, momentous speech. And to say that in Israel certainly was fantastic. But what I actually object to, his father not only was a Nazi, but he actually signed the deportation of Jews from France, which is well known because his father actually was sentenced for it in the Nuremberg process after the war. And Richard von Weizsäcker, being a lawyer, defended him. And he never quite... He always said, oh, well, you have to understand, and difficult times. And the German public always sort of had allowed him to get away with it. Although he's known, he's a criminal in the Nazi. He really was responsible for the death of many Jews deported from France. It was sort of glossed over. And I think in that way, it's a very German story, because we have quite a few figures. Günter Grass is another one, who... were huge moral instances after 1945, did fantastic things, as a speech from Richard von Weizsäcker, which really was great, but on the other hand had personal stories that we somehow didn't dare to speak about. And that's sort of created an atmosphere of hypocrisy, which I actually grew up in and which I still detest.
Well, Imke, really fascinating stuff. And it's amazing how these stories that today have kind of echoed with events from 40, 50 years ago, as well as more recent weeks. That was, of course, Imke Henkel, who's Die Zeit Online's London correspondent, and comes in now regularly to run through the German weeklies with us. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. Up next, we'll hear how an experiment to simulate life after an apocalypse went a bit wrong.
Covering everything from Security Council shifts at the United Nations to smart startups in the Hudson Valley, Monocle's New York Bureau's beat can also extend all the way down to Argentina and up and over to Alaska. Ed Stocker is our Bureau Chief in New York.
From business to politics via the arts, we're tapped into what's happening in this fast-paced city across the US and travelling into Latin America.
With one of the biggest beats in our correspondent network, New York Bureau Chief Ed Stocker is just as likely to be reporting from Mexico City or Medellin as he is from Manhattan. You can hear his report across the schedule here on Monocle 24.
And welcome back to Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. Imagine life after an apocalypse. What would you do if all civilization as you knew it vanished? Academic, philosopher and journalist Dylan Evans was so intrigued by this question that he set out to find the answer 9 years ago. He left his job, moved to the Scottish Highlands and founded a community called the Utopia Experiment. There he tried to live with no modern technology or comforts. The experiment wasn't a success. It was, in fact, more of a disaster. Now, Evans has written a book to go through those events and to find some answers why this kind of experiment often goes wrong. And I'm proud to say that Dylan Evans, the author of Utopia Experiment, joins me in the studio. Now, Dylan, I'm not sure if that's a fair... we're trying to sum up your life. Explain to us why you decided to go and set up this project.
So I was, there's a number of things, really. Firstly, I was, in 2005, I was becoming increasingly alarmed about the predictions of our civilization perhaps collapsing due to running out of oil, climate change, economic crises and demographic pressures. And I began to wonder what it would be like if that actually happened. How would the survivors of an advanced developed country like the UK or the US, people who have lost all touch with our sort of traditional way of living, how would we be able to cope?
So you found a place to go in Scotland and then you advertised for people to come and join you.
Yes. So I put a sort of just a brief short page up on the internet, up on my site, saying, volunteers sought for an experiment in post-apocalyptic living.
And it went wrong in what sense? Because I know by the end of it, you were seeking psychiatric help. It was that tough on you.
Yes.
But what went wrong with this? And do you feel that it's the same kind of echoes that we've seen from, kind of hippie communes in the 60s, to the attempts, in more recent years to kind of set up alternative communities that have often then fallen apart?
Yes. Well, I mean, when I say it went wrong, I think it went wrong for me personally. But I think many of the volunteers seemed to get a lot out of it. So I'm glad that they at least enjoyed the experience. But for me, I think it was a combination of factors. One of them was that I was trying to do two different things. I was the person who was setting up and organizing and documenting the experiment, and I was also a participant, and those two things were not really easily compatible. I was taking on far too much. But also the fact that I was just ruminating every day about the civilization collapsing. I mean, it can get you down.
And also, I think that it was striking. There were some very simple moments in the book when I think a guy cuts his hand with an axe and you take him to hospital and you realize, that actually being, cut off from the rest of the world, you're dependent on all these really basic things, like, can you go and, have a wound looked at in a hospital?
Right. So I did feel that was another kind of constant source of tension for me, was this, I felt like I was constantly making compromises between the reality of the simulation that we were trying to live out and the fact that, civilization hadn't actually really collapsed. But where do you draw the line? If someone cuts their finger when they're chopping wood, to be really in keeping with the spirit of the experiment, you shouldn't really do anything. You should shouldn't take them to hospital. But on the other hand, you have some kind of responsibilities to that person. Also, for example, after 7 or 8 months, we were still not self-sufficient. We were still popping down to Tesco's. And that was like, this is not working quite as I intended. And I felt like a fraud.
And how did the governance go?
Well, again, I was very naive when I went into this, you know, and I thought we would all, you know, we would all somehow manage to pull together and it would be a wonderful community. And I, when people said to me, no, there's going to be power struggles, I was brushed them aside and said, no, we're all going to sort of pull together and we're going to, because we're going to be survivors. But of course, there are always power struggles that people have egos and they want to, there are some very forceful personalities there.
Now, we've only got a few seconds left, but tell me, so although the biggest project wasn't a triumph, have you taken something away from it in your daily life? Do you feel a little bit more kind of robust about how you deal with, you know, with things?
Well, for a long time I didn't, but I think looking back on it now, I did learn some very valuable lessons about myself in particular and about, you know, that actually there are some pretty good things about civilization and we shouldn't try and wish it away.
Well, brilliant. Dylan Evans, the author of The Utopia Experiment, thank you very much for joining us. The book is published by Picador and it's out on Thursday. I think you can go to that thing Google and you can find anywhere to purchase it there. But you're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. And it's time now for our daily arts review. And today we're going to be talking music. Crispin Parry from British Underground, a music development agency, spoke to Monocle's Marcus Hippie just before the start of the programme. They started by talking about the events that Crispin produced in Brazil.
We host an exchange project with Brazil, primarily in the northern states. So we do a lot of work in Bahia. And we've this year gone for the first time to Pernambuco. The shows are, well, it's shows, it's recording, it's what's called a cultural collaboration. Our work is basically making all of this fit together. We've been doing this for a few years. We bring artists from Bahia over to London. They perform with UK artists. We've done stuff at the Roundhouse in London and at the Great Escape. And I've just come back from the Brazilian leg of that trip.
And you were producing those events with Trinidadian Bristolian duo just now.
That's right. I mean, they're a very interesting act. They are producers, literally. So what we were able to do whilst we were in Bahia this time is go into a recording studio and work with some local traditional artists.
And Crispin, your first song is actually from that duo just now.
Yeah, and this is a track called Turn Up.
That was Turn Up by Joss Now, Trinidadian Bristolian duo. How much more can you tell about these producer guys? How did they get together?
Well, it's very interesting, actually, the way that we did this particular collaboration that you'll hear some of the artists who worked on it again in a minute. But they are, I think that the percussionist, Keshav, he comes to Bristol and lives there for 6 months a year. So they do a lot of work. They spend a lot of time in the recording studio. I came across them last year when we did our events in the Great Escape and in the Roundhouse. And they got on very well with a particular producer from Bahia, and they went out early to record with him. So it was quite an interesting. They're a great and very dynamic and very interesting creative duo, actually.
And who did they work with in this song?
So, on that song, I think it's Bunji Garlim. And what we're going to listen to in a little while is some very traditional music. I mean, their ears are very open and they're very wide. So they selected artists that we came across from the local region, and it's quite, you know, a very, very big contrast. When you hear this, you will hear a very traditional choir and a very traditional berimbau player.
Let's continue with your second song for today.
So this is a local choir made up of grandmothers, mothers and daughters. I guess there are about 30 of them in the group. They come from an area called Itapau, which is a coastal neighbourhood of Salvador, and they're called As Gandeiras de Itapau.
Faz só, meu Deus, pra lavadeira lavar. Oh, lavadeira.
só, meu Deus, pra lavadeira lavar.
So that's a song called Canto de Lavadeira, and that's by Askan Hadira's Tejapua.
Can you tell me about the process, by the way, when you were producing these events in Brazil? How did you basically make the decision, first of all, who to collaborate with, what kind of artists to bring to these events, and so forth?
You do need to work with people who are prepared to really be very open-minded about how they work. We were very lucky to find a studio in Salvador that we recorded in, which was owned by a Brazilian pop star from the 80s. So it was quite a nice place. So we knew it was going to be good. They had a record label. They just started their own record label. So that's how we came across the band of the women's choir. And then the other person, who is a guy called Master Lorenbaum. Now, he was... We work also with a curator and a very good sort of networker in this area called Jody Gillett, and she introduced us to this artist. So they're just people in our network that we are able to sort of hook up and connect together. We hope they would never work. They would never work together unless we bought that. So it's a very unique combination.
We still have time for one song. Before you introduce the song, could you tell us why you chose that specific track?
This is a guy who plays an instrument called the berimbau, which is a gourd and wire and wood instrument. It's a very traditional instrument from the area. He's probably in his late 60s. I think he hadn't recorded for about 20 years, so it's a very interesting thing that's about to happen. And he's obviously working with a very contemporary electronic band, so being in the studio and watching that happen was a very moving experience.
What happened? What's the story? What's the backdrop to all that? Why did he start recording again?
Well, I mean, this is the thing that will hopefully come out. I think in the studio, there was talk that I think his brother may have died, and there may be an incident that stopped him. I think may have been very personal to him as to why he actually stopped doing it. I think the song we're about to play was written by this brother, so it's taken him some while to come back into recording and to do it here. I mean, there wouldn't have been a huge amount of opportunities, but to record it here and with these guys is a very moving tribute to them and him, actually.
A very personal song, and could you give us the name of it and the name of the artist as well?
So the song is called Atomic Bomb, and it's Master Lorenbaum.
Let's have a listen.
Vai estourar a bomba atômica. Vai estourar a bomba atômica. A humanidade não vai suportar. A vegetação não vai resistir. Astronautas vão se renegar quando estourar a bomba atômica.
Your third song pick for today was called Atomic Bomb. It was by Master Lorenbaum, also from Brazil. Are we going to see Master Lorenbaum coming to Europe anytime soon, do you know?
I really hope so, because I found this record. I mean, the record is called The Art of Master Lorenbaum. I think it was recorded live in 1997. It's a very, very, very good record. I mean, he's an old man now, so he can't travel everywhere, but I think plans are afoot to get him at least out into a few shows in Europe and the United States.
Well, that was Crispin Parry from British Underground speaking to Monocle's Marcus Hippie. And that's all we have time for on today's Midori House. My thanks in particular to our special guests, Kathleen Burke and Isabel Hilton. Today's show was produced by Marcus Hippie, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Alia Massoud. And our studio manager was Chris Chilvers. Next, after the headlines, is Monocle's Design Programme Section D with Tom Morris. Then at 2200 hours, it's Monocle Daily with Marcus Hippie and Peter Cardwell. The show will be back at the same time tomorrow, which is 1800 hours London time. But for this edition, goodbye.